Thanks, Mary, and it's great to be here. It's really fabulous to work with Robin and the Hep C Resource Centre. One of the things we attempt to achieve is to broaden our networks to try and make sure that we are more successful with our advocacy work. But I would also like to start by acknowledging the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land. When Agnes Shea, I'm sorry about my slides, I've just cut off a little bit of the bottom and I thought I could fix it, but I haven't. So I'll read for you what it says in a sec. But one of the things that Auntie Agnes says in these sorts of forums when she introduces us is she asks us to leave a soft footprint on Ngunnawal land. And I think that it is a wonderful description, but it's a description that says that you can leave some footprint. And I think that our footprint should be about making the lives of all the people who are living on Ngunnawal land to be just that much better, particularly Indigenous people. And we've done very poorly, as I'll get on to in due time. So they have my respect and, of course, their elders who are with us now and who have passed. And the statement here is, Ngunnawal people have always lived here. In this place we sang and danced and laughed. Young men became wise men. The sky and the earth gave us food and water. Then others came. Oops, going the wrong way. The Public Health Association of Australia has as its prime driver equity, and that's based, that equity drives us to look at the social determinants of health, and I'll come back a little bit to those in a while. But by and large, we focus on prevention. We look at, in mechanical sense, for a long time, public health looks at clean water, sanitation, immunisation, health promotion and health protection. And I'd like to tell a little story about one of my heroes, which is John Snow. And many people, unfortunately, may have heard this. Some of you will have heard this story before. Some of you will have a different take on it than I do. John Snow was a doctor who was treating a stack of people for cholera in London in 1854. And he decided that it was a bit strange, or it seemed strange to him, that he didn't seem to be treating some people from one side of the street when he was always treating people from the other side of the street. So he conducted what was really the first thorough epidemiological study of going and door knocking and finding out who had cholera and who didn't. And in fact found it was a very clear line, and the cause of the cholera was actually the Broad Street pump, which was picking up sewage. And what Snow did was he actually removed the handle of the pump because he couldn't get governments to do anything about it, because governments believed at the time that cholera was spread in the same way that flu and other things are spread just in the air. He did that, and then he went about trying to convince governments to do something about it. But in fact, he had no success at all until, you can almost read it, until 1858. And 1858 is what Londoners describe as the Great Stink. And it was so unbearable because of the raw sewage in the Thames and so forth, particularly flowing past Westminster, that the Houses of Parliament couldn't even sit. And so they went home. And in fact, it was that Great Stink, with the background of the work done by Snow, that caused the government to put the whole sewage system, one of the great engineering feats actually of our time, through London. And so the message here is that the background research that you do is really important and significant, but for those of us who are advocates, it is really also to create a great stink at the right time. So what we need to do is identify the problem and advocacy. Now, hepatitis C, when I look at a range of different statistics, I find that they are quite variable. We do know, the Resource Centre has provided me with these figures about Hep C, 264,000 people in Australia, estimated 197,000 people who actually are infected with hepatitis C, 39,000 of them probably not even aware. And I think one of the interesting figures comes from prisons, because we keep getting variable figures, and Mary quoted from one from New South Wales, but there's a series of them. They vary a bit, but I think we can't lose the message that in prisons there is a very, very high prevalence of hepatitis C compared to the general community, that is around 2%. So we do have a significant problem, and if the statistics vary from place to place, that shouldn't allow us to slow down on our advocacy role. And let's put it in the context of who is affected mostly. Well, Sir Michael Marmot has just brought down a report of the World Health Organization on social determinants of health. And although this graph is not from that report, he has said for many years, even before he did that report, that inequity is on a social gradient, is his language. In other words, the healthier you are, the wealthier you are, and it's more or less a straight line. And you can see it on this graph, although in some other graphs it is even clearer that is the case. So if you are poor, then your health outcomes are likely to be poorer. If you live in Australia and you are poor and you are Indigenous, then they will be even poorer still. So where have we come over the last 20 years or so? Well, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody was commissioned just over 20 years ago. And in spite of that, we have 22,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with hepatitis C. And in 1991, when the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody looked at the issue, it didn't just say, look, the problem is that Aboriginal people are dying in custody at a proportion much greater than other people. In fact, they actually reported that the rates per capita were about the same. The difficulty was there were that the rates of incarceration of Aboriginal people was so such a high proportion compared to non-Indigenous people that they then appeared to be dying at a much greater rate in prisons. And they are incarcerated at something like, and I'll come back to it, but something like 13 times the rate of non-Indigenous Australians. So the really frustrating and sad part for those of us who believe that something needs to be done about Indigenous health is that there are actually more Indigenous people in custody now than before the report of the Aboriginal deaths in custody that said, here's a template, here's a plan of how to go about changing it. And we're just not doing it. And that is, I think, the sad part about it. Add to that the growth of diseases like hepatitis C and HIV/AIDS, and we see that there is an even more significant problem. So to what extent was it a success? Well, 14% of people, of Aboriginal people, prisons were made up of 14% Aboriginal people then and 24% now. It's a really significant increase. And yet this is only 2.5% of the total Australian population. And it is actually, in many ways, even a sadder indictment than the notion of closing the gap in a 17-year gap. That's bad enough. But, and these two, of course, are not so different in what happens. And so let's have a look, I thank Professor Ted Wilkes for this slide. It's a really interesting and such a clear way of looking at how of the rates of Indigenous people compared to rates of non-Indigenous people in each jurisdiction. So it is a focus that we do need to look at. And it's really interesting also to look at what's the major concerns of prisoners, and it doesn't matter whether you're Indigenous or non-Indigenous, the biggest concern is about drug use. And I have to say, why wouldn't it be? Just put yourself sitting there in a prison for some time, your sense of hopelessness, what were the set of circumstances that got you there in the first place, and clearly drugs are going to provide a compensation, a way out. There's a range of ways of looking at that, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of the comments from John Van Dungen later on, because I've heard him speak earlier about these issues and the sense of hopelessness that people have, and why it is then that they have a issues with drugs in prisons. Although, of course, apparently we're going to be able to keep drugs out of the Alexander McConaughey Centre just because it's not done anywhere else in the world doesn't mean it can't be done here. We shouldn't give up before we start, apparently. But it's, the problem, of course, is complex. It's not just about injecting drugs in prison. It's not just about the illicit drugs. Substance misuse amongst prisoners is very, very high levels, as we're illustrated here. Alcohol, of course. Tobacco, extraordinary rates of prisoners who smoke. And then the illicit drugs. And why the prevalence of hepatitis C so high in prisons? Well, perhaps part of the reason behind that is the people who are incarcerated already have been involved in a crime associated with their drug use. So, of course, there's a factor there. Because when you look at each one of these factors and you're dealing with the health of prisoners, you are dealing with a whole range of very complex set of issues that all interrelate. And so the challenges are great. But the message from me is going to be very clear. While you work on all those challenges, and we do understand how complex they are, it is still absolutely fundamental that there is a needle and syringe program that operates in the Alexander McConaughey Centre. So we thought that the Public Health Association, having been involved in this, ran a conference just recently on justice health in Melbourne, and some of people who are here today were at that conference. And I've just dragged out the headings of the resolutions and picked out one or two of the resolutions. In fact, even the shortened form has 13 resolutions. The long form, I think, has 40-something or other. But in advocacy and research, it's a really important fundamental part to start with respecting Australia's local, international and human rights obligations with regard to prisoners. And I'm going to come back to that. For Indigenous Australians, the resolution was adopt an Indigenous holistic health focus, particularly for Indigenous prisoners. I have to say, I think we should adopt that sort of a focus for everybody. But Indigenous people have actually had this approach for many, many years, and it's something that we should have learned from them probably when we arrived in Australia. In health services and planning, it's time to make sure that there is some relationship between the states and some consistency. And I think one of the most important things that we did at that conference was say it's really important to recognise and respect the role and the contribution of staff throughout the justice system. It's very easy for us to say, oh yes, but they're only objecting to it and they have this and so on. But actually they have a really difficult set of jobs and a really difficult set of challenges, and I've yet to meet somebody who hasn't taken those sets of challenges seriously, even if they have a different opinion from me. And we need to engage with the unions, we need to engage with people in the prison system to try and make sure that we can bring some influence on them. That's part of the role of advocacy. And in a framework with regard to blood-borne viruses, other drugs, a harm minimisation framework for prisons is really the fundamental driver of, in my mind, of the way we should think about that. And the other area that the Justice Health Conference looked at was mental health and comorbidity issues, and that emphasises, and the emphasis really was, that these are extraordinarily complex issues. In the particular area of bloodborne viruses, we also talked about, within the harm minimisation strategy concept, use of opioid replacement therapies, and even piloting a heroin trial. Now, I know that is looking a bit further forward, but actually John Howard's not there anymore, and he stopped it in its footsteps last time. Even though Ministerial Council on Drug Strategy was the supposedly the highest body making law with regard to drugs, so let's keep going. Let's aim for the stars. And if we just get to the moon and get a needle and a syringe program in a prison, it's not a bad achievement. You can see the other ones. The last one you've can't quite read, says ensuring national availability of condoms, dams, lubricants in both adult and juvenile correction facilities. So I think one of the important things that that I've been talking to the media about today is the revolving door of prisons, that Australian average time spent in incarceration is 7 months. And that actually really spells out something for those of us who want to look at it from a selfish perspective in the community, that this actually just might affect us, because actually when you have a prevalence of well over 50% of Hep C in prisons and people are coming out after 7 months, then actually they are going somewhere and they just might be they just might be a risk to the broader community, and hepatitis C is not something that we want to see spread any further. And the impact, of course, on Indigenous people is even greater. And I'll put some of the statistics there. One of the things, though, that really struck me very, very strongly at the Justice Health Conference when Ted Wilkes spoke was his notion, or how he spoke of the normalisation of incarceration amongst Indigenous people, that it is just a normal part of growing up. There's somebody in your family, might not be a very immediate family, certainly an uncle, and in fact, it's even worse. He went a step further and said, in some ways, it's almost becoming a rite of passage. Have you done your time? And that, of course, is a yet another factor that means that we're not only going to see the spread of hepatitis C grow, but we're going to see it grow first and foremost in our Indigenous communities. And what impact will that have on closing the gap? So, the new prison, and beautifully named Alexander McConaughey. I'd love to know actually who thought it up, but I think, and it was the Stanhope government that adopted it, and I think it's great. And for those of you who haven't been into the government site here and looked up the name of it and what Alexander McConaughey did in his time, it's worth doing, because actually the reforms that he was talking about close on 200 years ago, actually lots of prisons in the world haven't done just yet, but quite a few have come some of the way, most of the way. So with that name, you would think that maybe what we should be doing is trying to look 200 years ahead again and say, well, what is it that that is so fundamental? And look, the fundamental thinking behind McConaughey was, these are people who are imprisoned and the punishment is deprivation of liberty. Apart from that, they're people. And we're going to work. And we're going to work with them. And they're going to make sure that we can treat them that way. In fact, we have to, because we have international obligations. In 1990, the General Assembly of the United Nations Resolution on the Basic Principles for the Treatment of Prisoners, at Article 9, says prisoners shall have access to the health services available in the country without discrimination on the grounds of their legal situation, or if you like, the deprivation of liberty. Well, actually, we do have needle and syringe programs in the community. And they are about health. And they are about improving the health of the community. So I would say that on that statement alone, we would have to face up to our obligations. Then, of course, we could look at the World Health Organization view. All prisoners have the right to receive health care, including preventative measures. Equivalent to that available in the community without discrimination. We have needle and syringe programs in the community. If we actually would like to think that as a developed nation we pay attention to the World Health Organization, then, in fact, not just now, from 1993, yeah, we're really getting behind it. So being denied an international right, of course, is a denial to justice. And I just came across this the other day, but like all these statistics, you know, I always worry because I keep seeing incarceration rates for different countries that are different ways, and you can't see the source because it's cut off on your one. It's a rate per 100,000 people. The source is the US BJS, and I can give it to anybody who wants it. But I really just wanted to use it as an illustration that if you look at the US, we know the US incarcerates at a far greater rate than anybody else, and that's why it has so much safer society than anywhere else. But it's really easy to sit on our whole health and go, oh, well, look, Australia's quite over to the left there, and we're not doing too badly, until you actually, and I just did a rough estimate, I said 13 times the amount, that puts the dot just there when I added it in. But it's just to illustrate the point that we can't sit on our high horse, and to emphasise again that the issue for Indigenous Australians is very important. I'll put John Stanhope's photo up here, not because he's necessarily one of my heroes, but actually he is in one way. And his ACT Human Rights Act was a major leading piece of legislation in Australia, and he certainly deserves every credit for it. But it also actually ties his hands a little, I believe. And Section 91, anyone, and his deals, what I think is fabulous is the ACT Human Rights Act actually applies to prisons. And that's actually a big step as well. And both those steps he took, and in both those areas, he does need to be given appropriate credit. And anyone deprived of liberty must be treated with humanity and with respect to the inherent dignity of the human person. And Dr. Watchers is here with us today. And in one of her recommendations on the audit of prisons and correctional facilities before Alexander McCunnachy Centre was opened, pointed out that needle and syringe programs ought to be introduced. And I have to say, for those of us who think about it, that it's obvious in a Human Rights Act those same international obligations that I talked about a short while ago apply. Even more defined in the ACT context, because we do have a Human Rights Act. And that's why it is that I believe it's appropriate to continue to put the pressure on the Chief Minister, on his colleagues, to ensure that prisoners in the ACT do have the same rights as people who are not incarcerated. And that's not unusual. So here's a list of countries that have needle and syringe programs. There's about a dozen of them. It would probably be easier for us if more of them spoke English, because then we could bring some of the warders out here and say, look, you know, English-speaking countries, of course, are at a much higher level than other countries, so therefore we can pay attention to you. Or we could just accept that maybe places like Switzerland, Germany, Spain, you know, places that are actually part of the European Union, might be as advanced as us in many ways, and perhaps a little more in other ways. So I think that we can see that these programs have been operating, do operate, in advanced countries. Of course they don't operate in exactly the same way as they do in the general public. Of course they have to be modified to suit a prison context. But they do operate. And, you know, the ACT has been quite a leader in many, many ways in social and moral legislation and areas, and it just is possible that we can do something about it. So how do we go about it? Well, we are an advocacy organisation, and one of the things we have learned is that you don't achieve advocacy by turning people off, that you actually achieve your advocacy mostly by engaging with people. And that's why it is that I think we all have a role to make sure, as I mentioned earlier, that we are engaging with staff within the correction system, with the unions, and so on. And it seems to me, and I've sort of put truth, which is a bit of a strong word really, that it's a moral issue for prison warders. And of course, for any generalisation like that, there's going to be a great stack of exemptions. But underlying, there is an underlying tone in which that is the case. And of course, we also know that prison warders have been part of the supply chain in some prisons. And we can actually understand that if you think about the job they're doing, and somebody who's on heroin is actually very easy to deal with. And they might not be otherwise. And so it's actually, although it's inappropriate, it is not that hard to understand. And of course we also need to engage with our politicians, with our local members, and so it's fabulous to have Mary here and listen to her introduction. But it's also about the other side. It's also about making sure that the opposition can understand what it is that you're trying to achieve, even if in the end they disagree. So we have John Stanhope and his government introduced the Human Rights Act into prisons, and it's a fabulous step. On the other hand, we did have Jeremy Hansen join us at the Justice Health Conference and participated right through the conference. So hopefully we will be able to bring some influence to bear on these issues. And it's worth just going back to some of those fundamentals for those of us who happen to believe in the public health approach. And the public health approach is set out in the Ottawa Charter. For those of you who don't know it, the World Health Organisation in 1986 established the Ottawa Charter. It's only about three or four pages, but by and large became an inspiration for almost anybody who was working in the public health area, and I see quite a number of them here today. And it does do those few things. It puts health on the agenda of policymakers, and it reminds us we need to use legislation, fiscal measures, taxation. We need to use organisational change to bring about better health for communities, but we also need to identify obstacles and then work out what are the best ways to remove them. And really, we should be trying to make easier choices for people such as policymakers and then people who are affected by the issues. And it's not a bad framework for us to think and operate. So coming back in terms of the advocacy that I mentioned, and I started with John Snow, but it wasn't so much the epidemiological and research work, it was fundamental. But in the end, the thing that actually made the difference was the great stink. And so I call on you, with regard to needle and syringe programs, please make a great stink.